podcast est présenté par la microbrasserie La Force du Malte, la bière du 12e joueur.
MLS, Ligue des champions, Euro, Mondial, on en parle tout le temps.
Ben des fois on parle de cuisine, mais pas longtemps.
Cannes Football Club,
c'est la référence soccer à Montréal. Tout simplement, les meilleurs. C'est le Cannes Football Club. La poutine du soccer.
Merci beaucoup de nous joindre au Couscous Piri-Piri et conversation avec Sofiane Benazza en mode solo. J'ai l'honneur d'avoir avec moi le directeur exécutif de l'Union des joueurs de la MLS, Mr. Bafous. Good day, Mr. Fous. Thank you very much for being on. And how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Thanks for having me.
Perfect. So, as the MLSPA's activities on Twitter has been, you know, getting more and more active, if I may say, but just to help us for our fans and whether Montreal Canada or whoever's listening, can you give us sort of big meta processes? Overview of how the MLS and the players negotiate for a new CBA. As we know, the upcoming CBA is expiring at the end of January 2020. So, how would it work in general terms to negotiate the new CBA?
Yeah, sure. It's I think for the most part probably right along the lines of what you would assume. It's a lot of conversations between a lot of people. So what has shifted over time a bit, which is a good thing, is we spend more time talking to the league about big picture CBA issues throughout the full CBA cycle, which is helpful because we start the process with each with a better understanding of where the other's coming from, what our priorities are, and things like that. Once the process starts, there are a couple of things that happen, and then they keep happening over and over until you find a way to reach a deal. So one of them is that we talk about financial issues and where the league is, and they have given us for the last decade real transparency on what the business itself looks like, and that's for MLS, for the teams, for some. All of that, and that's extremely helpful because it allows us to speak the same language, if you were, on economic issues so that we each understand the reality of the business and we're each able to make proposals that are based in that reality. So that's very helpful. And then we, you know, really just start exchanging proposals and having conversations at the table, as we say, and it really is just that. It's a big table, depending on how many folks are there, and players and the PA staff on one side and the league staff on the other side, and we talk through those proposals. And then there are some issues that are, if they're legally sort of more complicated, we might handle them away from the table. So it might be legal staff to legal staff that's exchanging paper and having conversations. And those could be on the phone. They could be in person. And so the process really just sort of goes back and forth. You make proposals. You sit at the table and talk them through. You might have more informal conversations in between the formal sessions where you explain what's going on, and hopefully you keep exchanging proposals and the gap narrows and you get to a point where there's an agreement to be had. So that's really it. It's as straightforward as you would otherwise think it is.
So basically the outlook calendar is reserved. Skype meetings and plane tickets are all set up. But what are the... Let's say, can you assume that most of the, let's say, the current active CBA, most of the points are sort of a given? This is a standard CBA, and the 5% of it, let's say, I'm using numbers for hypothetical, 5% of the pending points and negotiation points are the main conversation topics throughout the negotiation?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. Now, but that has evolved and continues to evolve. You know, as a relatively young players association, the first CBA we did, we had to do from scratch. So literally we had to negotiate every single word in an 80-page document. Yeah. With each subsequent CBA, we tend to have sort of, quote, finished more issues, and therefore the number of things we're talking about becomes much more manageable and much easier. So, you know, I don't know if we're talking about, we were talking about hundreds of issues the first time through and, you know, making these numbers up, but yep, there are maybe 10 to 12 to 15 major issues.
Yes.
Now, and then another 30 or 40 things that each side may have, which can be, you know, sometimes changes, but also sometimes just trying to agree on solutions to new problems. So an example of that would be technology issues. So biometric technology wasn't a phrase that even anyone would have understood when we were talking about our first CBA, and that's something that's really exploded. And there's lots to talk about now on that front, and there's lots that's going to come that we can't even imagine yet at this point. So those kinds of things make their way in as well.
Oh, for sure. And things have changed since you've you know, you're part of the PS formation in 2003, so you've seen, you know, different CBA negotiation rounds, very different from one CBA to another. Technology has changed, the medium has changed, and a point you brought earlier was the economy. So MLS has sort of transformed itself since you joined the PA, and since I've been covering MLS in 2012, we've seen the league economically change drastically. And how does I'm not sure if the MLSP has an opinion on this, or is it more the players than the actual PA, but how do you see the sort of, I will use the word frantic, expansion or aggressive expansion of the league, every franchise coming in? You know, for the PA, it's great. It's more potential union members, more job for players. That's great news. But how does the MLSPA, if it has an opinion on the, you know, ever-growing expansion of the league that hasn't stopped since, let's say, the Impact joined in 2012, We've seen more new clubs coming in than anything else.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the first thing I would say is just to your original, how you started the question, you know, the views of the PA are the views of the players, and that's okay. What we are. There's no distinction there. We take our cues from them on every issue. Generally speaking, as you mentioned, I think we're positive on expansion. As long as it's being done intelligently and the markets coming in are good markets and the organizations are good organizations. I think in terms of markets, I think the league has done an exceptionally good job in the last decade of picking good markets and places where it's a positive for MLS to be. In terms of organizations, there's been more variation. We've had some that have come in really ready to go and doing everything the right way. And we've had some, frankly, that have come in and not been yet prepared to do things the right way. So on those issues, obviously, we have a strong opinion when things aren't being done properly or when players aren't being treated the way we think they should be treated. But overall, you know, as long as expansion is rational and measured and we can continue to draw, you know, players and keep the level of play improving, mm-hmm. then it's a good thing. And, you know, we're very lucky on that front. It's a different proposition for us than the other North American sports because it's such a global game and there are 65,000, I think, plus professional players around the world. So expansion's a bit easier. What we're doing isn't really going to move the overall needle in terms of supply and demand for players a lot. So that's helpful.
Is there a worry? At least, you know, MLS has been relatively struggling to the other major leagues in North America vis-a-vis its TV deals. So I've been seeing, I won't say people, I'll say myself, I've been seeing, am I incorrect in perceiving the expansion process, you know, bringing in very high expansion fees as a sort of, if you know, inflation type, you know, increase to the MLS value, or is that something that there worries the players? Okay, we have all these new franchises, we're happy, more spots, more money, better negotiation. But at the same time, are players worried about the TV deals not being as high as maybe they would want to? And are the expansion fees just a way to sort of gives the MLS more time and more financial freedom to be able to get there eventually? Because I do see it as sort of, it does seem like a sort of inflationary effect maybe, but at the same time, I'm not an economics expert. I want to see what was the PA's opinion on this.
Yeah, no, it's, and those areas really, our interests are pretty well aligned with the leagues. When you're talking about revenues, we want to see revenues increase just as much as they do. So that's certainly applies to the upcoming broadcasting deals. They will be extraordinarily important in charting and impacting the course of the league moving forward. And we are watching all of the developments in that area very, very closely. And there is a ton of change going on globally in that space and more broadly just content generally. So there's a lot to try and digest and think through. On the expansion side, it's a bit different because those aren't revenues. What they are and what I think the league has done a pretty good job of doing is using those expansion fees to finance the growth of the league or part of the growth of the league. And that has been done effectively because the league has grown substantially. The risk there is, and I think everybody understands this, that's not a business plan and a business model that's sustainable forever. So there's going to come an end to that source of financing. But in the meantime, we've seen it help with lots of infrastructure that needed to be built out and investment that needed to be made. So in that sense, it's a real positive from our standpoint.
No, it's true. It's true. It's maybe I shouldn't panic as fast as I did, but no, I understand the whole balance between what the players want and need vis-a-vis aligning the players and the league being aligned together towards, you know, more revenue, which is true. It's a win-win for everyone at the end. But, you know, there was a few notable players. I think the most vocal one, at least, was Wayne Rooney when he was talking about the conditions, players' condition in MLS. And one interesting point that he made, two of them, and let's talk about the first one that pops up, it would be the player's salary. And I've read a few articles where yourself and different other representatives of MLSPA were talking about how they can negotiate. They would like to negotiate the higher salary budgets from clubs to be able to pay players a bit more and get more players. Is that something that you can do in a CBA in a sense, like sort of not force, but negotiate a higher salary budget for salaries, for player salaries on clubs? Is that something that clubs have to accept or willing to accept? Or how would you convince a whole league to increase, let's say, by 20% the budget for salaries?
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly something that we are have been and will continue to negotiate with the league in terms of what's going to be spent. And there are two pieces to that. The overall amount obviously matters to us and is significant. And there it ties back to that financial transparency. You know, our proposals are very much driven by what we're seeing in terms of revenue growth in the league. So we work very hard to make proposals, financial proposals, that are rational within the context of what the business is generating. And, you know, that is the sort of crux of that negotiation. The equally important and maybe even more important side of things from our standpoint is the overall fairness and competitiveness of the system. And that gets into a whole bunch of issues that are extremely important to us, particularly in this negotiation and that we're spending a lot of time talking about. So what I mean by that is we want to see a system that is more transparent, much simpler, and provides a real level playing field for all players within the context of whatever those ultimate numbers are. So it's not just the dollars that are available, that certainly matters, but it's then how players and which players are able to access those dollars. And in our world, we want to see a system where everybody gets to compete equally for all of the dollars that are out there in the system, We think that competition and competitiveness overall in the system will make MLS a better league. And we think that same concept of competitiveness needs to be extended more than it has been throughout the system. So we think the teams should be competing with each other just as hard as players are on the field. They should be doing it off the field. And we also have not seen that as much as we would like in the past. So we've seen a lot of protection for poor performing franchises and a sort of a defensive attitude taken overall. And it is, you know, certainly high time that start to shift and we start to see teams be forced to compete and to stand or fall on their own performance. So we want to see more decisions being made at the club level. We want to see the clubs have more flexibility in terms of how they construct their rosters with the available dollars that are out there. And within the context of a negotiated financial system that is rationally tied to revenues, that's the way that we will see MLS improve the most is through those things. So it's really about fairness and it's about competition from our standpoint when we talk about systems.
Going back to your point about clubs being competitive against each other at a higher level, do you feel that a more expansive or at least a true free agency concept in MLS will help the players get the clubs to be able to compete?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. Free agency and the freedom to move will make MLS a better league. And the more of it we have, the better we'll be. And there's no question at all in our minds about that. In addition, if you look at the converse, trying to restrict movement in the context of a global game where no one else is doing that, it doesn't have much of an impact and doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to talk about restricting movement when you're in a closed system where there's nowhere else to go, like the NFL in large part. It's very, very different in our world where everybody's free to go wherever they want in every league around the world. But MLS applies certain levels of restriction on certain players. That system is not fair and does not encourage competitiveness to the extent that we think it should. So that's a big, big issue for us.
And if we talk about conditions for clubs being able to be more successful, you know, sort of a, I wouldn't say a running gag, but more of a sort of a running joke that's been a bit sad right now around the whole issue of charter flights for players. You know, a few players coming from abroad. And are, you know, specifically when Rooney has talked about it a few times, whereas it would have been, you know, interesting to have more charter flights. And when I read the CBN, I think we went through it a couple of years ago with yourself, Bob, about the fact that right now in the current CBA, MLS lets four legs of flight to be used as charter flights, up to four legs of flight in a chartered flight for clubs. They don't have to use them, but they can use up to four. Is this... In a sense, do you think that at this, the new CBA, if it's ratified, you could get more charter flights? Could it be unlimited? Is it a restriction from clubs that don't want to pay more? Is it? I'm not even sure to understand why this is still an issue after, you know, it's been since the impact joined 2012. It's still an issue instead of sort of, it's starting to be a sort of a running gag a little bit because it's a bit sad for the league trying to expand. As expanding, you know, technologically, globally, sports-wise, in every aspect, but people can't travel let's say in the States, which for me, it's more than a country, it's a continent. So it's, I think it's very important. I don't know how much the MLSPA can do and force MLS to be able to have a more flexible and more comfortable flight arrangements for its players.
Yeah, this is a source of significant frustration for us, and we certainly agree with you that the league has not done a good job on this issue and not enough progress has been made. And I would extend that criticism to the teams as well, because from what we're seeing, even the minimal number of charters that the league allows them, teams are only using, by our survey last year, roughly half of the available charters were used. So teams aren't even using the ones that are available, and we think that's a real mistake. And to be clear on what how we view this issue, and this is sort of a third prong of what's most important to us in this negotiation to go with competition and fairness, is the notion of continued investment. And that's something that doesn't need to change, but it needs to continue. And this is the prime example of how it needs to continue. So charter flights, from our perspective, are not and should not be a collective bargaining issue. You don't see provisions on charter flights in the other collective bargaining agreements in the other sports in North America. And that's because they're not a player perk or a player benefit. They go straight to performance. And players cannot perform at their peak or close to it with travel the way it is currently at MLS.
Basically, they should be considered as having a training facility or a flight charter. There should be the same level of benefits.
Yep, that's exactly right. We view them as exactly the same issue as a training facility. If you want to be world class and you want your players to perform, this is something that has to happen. It's also expensive, and we understand that. But what's most disappointing is really there has been no progress or virtually no progress in the past 5 or 6 years. And given the cost, I think that was a real mistake. A much better approach would have been more incremental growth and incremental improvement so that we could reduce the impact of this issue. But instead, we really sat still for all that time, and that's unfortunate. So this is something we're going to have to talk about, and that's unfortunate because it isn't something that we should be talking about at the table. It's something that should be happening naturally through the evolution of clubs and in the improvement of clubs.
And going back a bit more locally in Canada, so this we talk about it a few times in Montreal and Canada, at least an issue with the international roster spots, at least sort of inequality between U.S. and Canadian clubs, not the league's fault up to a point, but just to remind everyone, in the U.S., for example, you're considered domestic if you're a U.S. citizen, you have a you're a permanent resident, meaning you hold a green card, or you have a certain special status, for example, refugee asylum status. And for Canadian clubs, let's say Montreal, Vancouver, Toronto, a domestic player is either a Canadian citizen or a person with special status, refugee or asylum status. And what I find interesting is that many U.S. clubs have found this sort of quick win loophole in the sense where they're able to give, international players, French, Venezuelan, wherever they come from, the U.S. green card very quickly, within a year, it seems. And the process in Canada to be a citizen takes at least 3-4 years easily after you become a permanent resident, if I'm correct. And I was told that this rule is basically, it's sort of an internal rule, because MLS cannot control what the U.S. Department of Labor and Immigration can do and what the Canadian and Canadian Immigration Department can do. These are not controlled by the league. Neither does the NBA has control of that or any other league that has teams in both countries. What I find interesting is that, I don't know, tell me if I'm wrong, Bob. For example, hypothetical, let's say the league says players who have green hair count as international players. Let's say that rule is not discriminatory. It exists in an alternate universe. In theory, this rule could be implemented by MLS because it's internal. And this has nothing to do with the Canadian law or U.S. law of labor. Basically, I can use any credit I want, and I could decide that there are these number of spots for these players have to be international players. Should the league be so restrictive? And knowing that the Canadian clubs are kind of losing this battle a little bit vis-a-vis the quickness for U.S. clubs to be able to get their players' green card, does the MLS has to do something about it? Is the MLSPA worried about this sort of double standard that the league can't really control at this point?
It's a complicated issue. I mean, let me say first and foremost that we certainly, I agree, with you that it's unfair to Canadian players that U.S. players count as domestics in Canada and Canadian don't count as domestics in the United States. And that is something that we would be very much supportive of. Unfortunately, it's not in our control and not something that we can dictate or even really negotiate given the legal structure. And the issues there, as you note, are complicated in each country and every country around the world based on their immigration policies and their discrimination laws and all of those sorts of issues. There's a broader point that I would make that is also unfortunate in my mind, which is I believe an open system around the world for professional footballers would be the best possible solution. Because again, I believe very fundamentally that competition is the best thing that we have and what will make us better the quickest. So if the systems were open everywhere, then there wouldn't really be much of an issue here. And players could go where they were best suited to play. What's unfortunate is that we have an extraordinarily open immigration system when it comes to athletes in the United States and in Canada. And then on the flip side, we see a lot of very, very closed and restrictive systems elsewhere. So we have an open system for others coming in, which I'm fine with and we're happy with. But then it's not fair because things don't move as freely the other way around. So that creates a real imbalance that we would love to see rectified. Unfortunately, that's a very, very, well, first off, it's a country-specific issue, and second off, it's a very complicated issue there. So the system is not perfect, clearly. At the same time, the Players Association represents every player equally, and we are agnostic as to where players are from. So what we want to see are the best players coming to play in our league and being treated fairly when they're here. So I understand it as a problem. I understand why folks in Canada are upset about it, and I'm extremely sympathetic to their frustration. Unfortunately, I'm not in a position to do anything about it.
Oh, for sure. But in theory, MLS could change that internal rule. They could use any criteria that you want to decide who's a domestic player or not. From my understanding,
you know, the federation's got a role in that as well. Oh, that's and true. You know, they dictate those rules currently, and I think that's true everywhere. So it's a little more complicated than that. But you know, the overall answer is yes. A decision could be made to change those rules, but it would have to be made within the context of the league and the federation's relationship, and then obviously within the context of the system of laws that are in place in the applicable country.
Have you heard anything from clubs in Canada? That last question for you, Bob. Have you heard any movement from Canadian clubs working towards solving this issue, or just status quo from your side?
I'm sure I haven't been involved in those conversations directly with the clubs, but I'm sure they're happening, and I know that those conversations have happened at the Confederation level as well. And you know, it's a topic that has been discussed repeatedly for many years, and I have no doubt will continue to be discussed.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Bob.
Ce podcast est présenté par la microbrasserie La Force du Malte, la bière du 12e joueur.